listener production.
Okay, here we go.
He is ice cool in moments like this.
Oh, the big fella runs back into heavy traffic. Look at him go!
And welcome to another edition of Woodsy's Club Tour. Got an NRL legend, two-time premiership winner, Luke Prittis. How you going, mate?
Good, Woodsy. Yourself?
Nah, going really good, mate. What's Luke Prittis up to these days?
I used to run a financial planning business. I've sold that and merged into another bigger organisation. So still doing the financial planning, which I sort of did when I was playing footy as well. Back in my era, some of us used to work for a living as well. A bit like you these days, mate. Still run the foundation, still the chair of the Luke Prittis Foundation. So that's been sort of running since 2006. And just family, mate. I said our sort of third child is got autism. Obviously, that's well known for a number of years now. And we're actually sort of in a bit of a battle of the NDIS at the moment. So plenty going on at the home front in our place.
And you know, when you were obviously playing, was that something you looked forward, like you were working hard on for when you did retire, so the transition was a lot easier with the financial business?
Yeah, well, I sort of started studying and got into the business sort of after I moved down from Brisbane to Penrith. So I sort of quickly realised in the financial planning game that things change pretty often, almost yearly. So if I wasn't sort of going to get into it and actually work in the system, then all the study would have been a waste of time. So basically I sort of hooked up with a group out here and Pete Mulholland, rest in peace, old Pete.
Great man.
He hooked me up with one of his mates out here in sort of the Penrith area, and I sort of joined them, and that's sort of how it works. I sort of worked sort of 1 or 2 days a week as I was playing. Didn't hit the golf course like Gowie and those blokes. I sort of actually jumped into the business suit and sort of slowly built up a business. And yeah, as sort of obviously that transition was pretty easy for me once I retired. Now obviously with the Dragons, won the premiership in 2010. Obviously didn't get to play, so that's a bit of a dirty issue. But anyway, basically packed up. We had our Mad Monday, went to Wollongong on the Tuesday, packed up on the Wednesday, and was in the office on Thursday. So it was a pretty easy transition back then.
But you know what, mate, that's a very smart transition, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of guys I've played with have finished the game and they've been that unknown. So it's so good that you've looked after yourself, mate, and from all reports, you've done outstanding selling your company and moving on to bigger and better things. Talked about as a junior, you're a Canberra boy, you know, you've come through the local grades, you played a couple of games for first grade at Canberra. Were you always a rugby league fan down there?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm a bush boy, so my old man worked for Coles Supermarket, so we moved around a fair bit. So started a fair bit, sort of first game, I think I was 4 years old, playing down at Wollongong. We moved up and I lived in Beverly Hills for quite a number of years. So Adam Peake, I don't know if you sort of remember, yep. Peaky, but basically played with him sort of for a year or two out at the Peakhurst Hawks, and basically then sort of moved out to Wagga, from Wagga moved to Canberra. Good to see that you've done your research there.
My little fella plays for Penshurst RSL, so we're in the local competition. Okay. Yeah. I know the area very well.
Basically moved out the Wagga, then from Wagga to Canberra, and that's sort of, I suppose, where serious footy started back in those days. Yeah.
And so when did you know you could play first grade? Because a lot of guys obviously say when they're younger, there was a light bulb moment, a switch. What sort of got you over the line to say, yeah, I can be a first grade rugby league player?
Oh, I don't know if there's really a switch there, Woodsy. Mate, I sort of always, I said, playing footy since age 4. I said, used to go and watch my old man play. He sort of played a bit of country first and that, back when that was pure country versus city back in those days.
Yeah.
So it was always around it. Yeah, it's not like the city lads playing country like I did. But, yeah, look, I made a couple of rep sides when I was younger, but then sort of towards the teenage, 15, not back 15s, it was Harold Matthews back in those days, sort of made that side but sat on the bench and then sort of didn't really do anything and switched to hooker as a 17-year-old, and basically from then made Australian schoolboys and moved on. So played flag and all that sort of stuff. So that's probably around the age, I suppose, that I thought there was a career to be happening. I obviously always wanted to play footy, but no. Study was a big thing in our household. So now I sort of made sure that I was doing the study. I went to uni after I played footy, after sort of finished school, still playing footy, and then continued that even when I sort of started playing first grade for the first sort of year while I was in Canberra.
And then obviously you have some talks with the super coach Wayne Bennett, or was that how did you get the opportunity to go to Brisbane? Was it through Wayne or any people spotted you?
Basically Canberra. So Simon Wolford was the other hooker that was sort of there at Canberra the same time. We got rid of Boxhead. He went to Townsville. He followed sort of Jason Deeth up to Townsville to go with Sheensy. And then it was sort of Simon and I. And I think 97, he started as hooker and then I sort of took over. And then 98, I sort of swapped back the other way. And basically being very similar in age, I think Germ's probably a couple of years older than me, but the club had to decide, I suppose, and they decided to go with Germ. So I'd actually signed with the Adelaide Rams, moved over to sort of Adelaide with a group of blokes, and Jason Ferris. He was over there. I think he's still over there at the Manly, the North Shore. He was over there. A lot of boys that I'd sort of played junior reps and that with sort of in Sydney, New South Wales, and that we moved over there. And I think I was sort of finishing off uni at that stage, so I came over late and probably only over there for 4 weeks, and we got bum-steered with the merger of the Super League and that come back in. And I'd already signed with, with News Limited back in those days. I wasn't actually sort of, I had a News Limited contract, so I wasn't going back to Canberra. I sort of made that clear and, reached out to Wayne, and there was no promises, but they were a News Limited club and decided to go up there and roll the dice.
Just before we obviously go on to the Broncos, how was the talks through the Super League? Because you said obviously you signed with the Adelaide Rams. Did you have any formal offers from any of the ARL clubs? And how was the negotiation part of things?
I was always Canberra. So, I mean, back in when it all started, I probably always say I was probably a year too young. So I missed out on sort of those big money contracts. Not to say that I didn't sort of do well. Let's face it, back in those days, there was good incentives built into a young bloke's contract. Probably a year young. But, I mean, I remember the ARL sort of after I'd made SG Ball and that wanted me to go up to Sydney and play for Manly, I think it was, for $15,000. And I wasn't a stupid kid. I knew that $15,000 in Sydney wasn't going to last real long. So starting, being at uni and that, I just basically politely declined and said, mate, I'm staying in Canberra basically for uni more than anything. Canberra came to the party and went on from there.
It's quite exciting. So then obviously the chapter comes, with the Broncos. We all look at the Broncos and the side they had, and so many people talk about the training sessions. It was like Origin training. You look at, Sivanasiva, obviously Webke up against Carlaw, just the bench were representative players. How was the culture up there when you first, first joined the club?
Yeah, sensational. Speaking to your young bloke just before I sort of come home for this and asked me the same question, what was the sort of the most professional club, Brisbane by a mile in terms of sort of back in my era. Again, that one club town, they're always been successful and it was really just sort of me fitting into the mould. There was an ethos back there, train hard, play hard, drink hard. Again, probably not the right thing to say these days, but it was true. You back in those days, you earned to have sort of a drink on the weekend or after a game. So there was no sort of, if you didn't train and we had sort of a team bonding session or something, if you didn't do the hard work, you sort of weren't really fitting into the ethos of the club there. And, they had blokes like Kevvy Walters. Alfie Langer was there for half a year for my first year up there before he pulled the pin and went over to the UK. But as you said, you could sort of go through all the players that I played with up there, and it was sort of a pretty fantastic forward pack at least. And I probably came in the back end of some of the classy backs. I said Steve Renouf, that was his last year as well. So, but certainly a good ethos up there. And look, they obviously lost their way there for a couple of years, but they sort of come back last year, and they'll always be a top quality club.
Oh mate, they're an absolute powerhouse. And, when you see them go not in the top eight, that's an unsuccessful year for them. And it just shows you how powerful they are. So you've come from Canberra, you've gone to Brisbane. You just said, the professionalism is the best club you've been to out of all of them. What's the difference? Like, what makes them so good compared to the other clubs you've been to, mate?
I think it had to do with the office as well. And again, you've come from one of those clubs that don't have a really good office there in the Tigers. And it's true. And again, I sort of go to even when we won to the premiership with Panthers in 2003, I guess it had been so long between drinks for Penrith that I suppose no one in the back office per se had experienced that sort of success. And obviously, no, we were only one game off in 2004, but after that, pretty much struggled to reach the semis for those rest of the years. So whereas Brisbane, you know, it was all about the players. I suppose Brisbane got it that if the club was successful, it was because the players were performing on the field. How do you help the players perform on the field? You don't give them everything, but you give them a fair bit of support to make sure that, no, they're doing the right thing, because if the players can do the right thing on the field and off the field, then, no, you're looking after sponsors, and that's part of the off-the-field thing back in those days, which, again, I don't think too many clubs really got it. But the Broncos, they had it pretty early. No, there was a roster of players. We had a roster of, no, you had to go and do this sponsorship. It was a non-negotiable. That's part of your playing contract. You got to be there. If you don't, then, no, there were serious issues. So they got the on-the-field and the off-the-field process right from the start.
They sure did. And you talk about the roster you had up there. You had blokes, obviously, Takiri, you know, one of our favourites, Wendell Saylor, big Gordy Tallis. Big Dell, he'll tell you how good he was every time I see him. What was the dressing room like? There was just so many personalities there.
Yeah, it was. It was good because everyone was sort of a bit different. Again, Alfie, even though I only got to play with him for that sort of half a year, always threw up before every game. Doesn't matter what sort of game it was. It was just a routine. You always threw up, so you knew that if he wasn't throwing up, something was wrong. But you had blokes that were really quiet. Then you had other, no, obviously, Kevy and that were jokers. But when, I suppose, the other ethos that we had is that once we come back from warm-up, from that game, and you're getting ready to cross what we call the white stripe, you had to be on. So it didn't matter what you did in the dressing room beforehand. There was blokes that would laugh and joke. Other blokes were quiet. Other blokes would go out and get a massage or whatever. But no, once you come back and Wayne addressed us, and we had sort of that 10 minutes before you were about to roll out, you knew that that was game time and everyone sort of just switched on. So I suppose that the characters all rolled in to make the side what they were. And I mean, you've been around long enough, Woodsy, that no, you need a few jokers in your side. You need some serious blokes. You need some good leaders. Brisbane, obviously, they had that.
You definitely need different people in the dressing room. You can't have all the same. You don't want a team full of stiffs. You don't want a team full of partiers. You want a little bit of a mixture, don't you? And then, you know, we speak about the players, but then you hear this aura of Wayne Bennett. Look, I've never been coached by him. I've heard so many, you know, good stories. Like, you know, we had young Tau Tau Moga in here once. Young Jaden Sewer from the Dragons, who had him at South. He come in his undies in the gym to pump the boys up one day because the mood in the change room was so low. Have you got any stories like that for us on Wayne? Like, how is he different to other coaches? And do you still find it incredible that he's still coaching to this day and still wants to keep coaching?
Yeah, I do. I always say that no matter my differences with Wayne, I still say to everyone he was the best coach that I had. And again, but someone, I suppose, up there in Brisbane, I had Bellyache, was my under-21 coach in Canberra. He went up to Brisbane and I got the opportunity. Obviously, he was Wayne's right-hand man up there. So I suppose out of Wayne and Bellyache was probably a bigger influence on my career at that sort of stage, because I found it easier to talk to Bellyache than Wayne. But I suppose in terms of the coaching, it is the cliche that no, Wayne has the ability to man-manage. Like, as much as he won't say it, he did bring in wrestling to the NRL. And when I was up there, we had this weird a wrestling coach that came in, and I used to love it because basically he taught me how to do a chokehold. And I remember that one day in the gym, Big Webby was sort of coming at me and mucking around, and bang, got him there and put him to sleep. So that was a good thing for me. And I think you look back in some of my career that I remember one time, a big Steve-O at the Sharks. I used to love playing against Steve-O because I'd choke him out and he'd get him all aggressive and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, Wayne, he's been there so long. But it's just the simple things. That's the biggest thing. And, again, I've had some sort of other coaches that come through. If you get the simple things right, and it may be boring that you spend an off-season doing fast hands and making sure that you're catching out in front and you can do that quicker and quicker, but every pass is 100%. If you're getting all those little things right, you can then move on to the other more complex things. But a lot of coaches think that you've made first grade and you know all those simple things and you spend too much time working all these complex plays. But at the end of the day, rugby league is pretty simple. You can dive over from dummy half a metre out and it's worth 4 points, or you can run 110 10 metres, it's still worth 4 points. So that's, I think, the ethos of Wayne is to keep the game simple. You stick to the simple game plan, and then when things are working well, that's when your Lockyers and those creative blokes can come out and take the game a bit further. If things then fall back, you fall back into your game plan. So that would be the one thing that I'd say for Wayne. It's you just kept things simple.
That's incredible. Just to say your fundamentals, just the little things, catch pass in front. So many kids don't even know what that is. Like, they just want to catch it and put the ball in their chest. So it's funny, just little triggers like that. Obviously, the 2000 year with the Bronx, did you know you had a winning side there at the start of the season?
Brisbane was always supposed to win. No, up in Brisbane, if you didn't make the grand final and you didn't win, it was sort of, that was a non-successful year. So obviously 99, we came off, and I suppose, you know, as I mentioned, I went up there. There was no guarantees. No, we lost our first, I think we won one and drew one out of the first 10 games or something. So that probably gave me an opportunity a bit earlier than what I thought. Plathy sort of was the dummy half back those days from the grand final, and Wayne made it abruptly clear, no matter how well I played in the trials, as much as I asked him if I play well, will I be a start? No, I won't, because I just come off winning, obviously, the 98 grand final, so I had to bide my time. But we then obviously came through and won, I don't know, a whole heap of games in a row to sort of finish in eighth position. And I think it was Parramatta back then that sort of knocked us out. We'd just sort of run out of the air. But I think that then led us into that 2000 season. And again, the calibre of players that we had, again, I suppose I will say it's more the forwards. Our backs probably weren't as flashy as what the Broncos have had in the past, but the forwards, they won the majority of the games. And to play in sort of a pack like that, and even the grand final, you know, it was the forwards that won it. Yep, backs do their job, but I think you sort of, if you look back, and you might not be old enough, Woodsy, but if you look back, our game was just based on a forward pack going forward. There was no sort of fancy stuff in our sort of game too much back then. The forwards dominated. If we dominated, we knew that we had enough class to score a couple of tries and win.
And so you said, obviously, that 99 year, obviously you didn't. I think it was at Parramatta you said that knocked you out. Did that give you a burning desire going into that pre-season for that 2000 year?
Oh, I don't know if it's a burning desire. Sort of, to me, 1 year's different to the next. I suppose it showed that the Broncos back then probably had never been through a tough trot like that. And again, I think it's reminiscent of some of the sides at the moment. No, Souths are obviously in the headlines. How do they get out of it? It's hard work. Well, it is. That's the only way you get out of it. But sometimes hard work takes a while. It doesn't just click because you decide, okay, well, I'm going to put an extra 10 or 20% effort at training. It doesn't work that way. So for the Broncos, as I said, to win one and have one draw out of 10 games and be way down the bottom of the ladder, that sort of was something that was unheard of. So to then come back and it clicked, and to start winning games and going on that roll and getting to, I think we got to eighth position. And then obviously that was a red hot Parramatta side back in that year. We obviously got knocked out in the first round of the semis, but to know that you can come back and overcome that sort of hurdle, I think it put the Broncos in good stead. Our side to know, okay, well, yeah, we can get through anything that's tough. And then that sort of 2000 a year, you start off, everyone starts on 0 points. Doesn't matter if you're a premiership or whatever, you start on 0 points, and it gives you that drive to, I suppose, say, well, we've got to work a bit harder.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I remember watching you in that 2000 year. It was unbelievable. It was, even that grand final, I think the fullback saved about 6 or 7 tries. It kept the Roosters in the game, but it just felt like that was one of the most dominant grand finals I've seen by a side. Like, I look at them, you know, Query, Saylor, just bringing the ball back. Yeah, I think you have young Berrigan in the side as well.
He was on the bench, I think, from memory.
Yeah.
Trying to work out. No, or actually, I don't know. No, I don't think he was. I think we had four forwards on the bench, to be honest.
But even you speak of those players, like you just look left and right of you, mate. You had Siv Nasiva, you had, you know, Tunza at the back, you know, just those likes, mate. Someone like Shane Webke, you know, we don't hear too much of him now. But I remember, like, just as a front row looking up to blokes like that, he was as tough as nails.
Yeah, he was. I think I was blessed in my career with Canberra as well as Brisbane, and somewhat obviously Panthers. But, you know, in Canberra, I got to play packed down as a 19, 20-year-old. I had Johnny Lomax on one side and Quinton Pong here on the other side. two Kiwi internationals. I had Dave Ferner that obviously knew how to throw them, sticking his head up my butt from the second row. Bradley Clyde. No, Clyde, he wouldn't punch his way out of a wet paper bag, but no, top bloke there. And Brett Hetherington, an old country boy from Young who could throw them as well. So, I was blessed in that side. And then they sort of come to Brisbane, and as you said, Shane Wigpe on one side. Petro sort of wasn't there for that grand final. It was Harvey Howard, the old Pommy. Harvey Howard, people forget that he sort of won that grand final with us. But then, and Rhino in the back row, Brad Thorne, as you said, Tunza, Gordy Tallis, great forward blokes to sort of been able to pack in. And as I said, you could be a bit of a cheeky hooker back in those days and do stuff, and knew that I was going to be protected no matter what happened. So there wasn't too many blokes that sort of came after you in a scrum when you had those blokes packing beside you.
Oh, mate, I don't doubt that. I reckon any front rower or any hooker or back rower would have looked up and just said, geez, where do I start with this pack? Unbelievable. So talk to us about the end of 2001 to 2002. You got the opportunity. How did that come about to come down to Penrith?
Wayne basically told me I wasn't wanted.
Straight to the point.
Yeah, straight to the point. I said, mate, I'm pretty black and white. So made New South Wales, and back then Origin, like your anti-tampering dem line was after sort of mid-Origin, sort of was June 30, whatever it was back in those days. So I had sort of got rid of a manager back then. Was doing it myself and basically was talking to them, and it was always okay, well, wait till after Origin, and sort of thinking what's going on here. And then, Origin finished, and obviously June 30 had come and passed by that sort of stage, and then, Wayne basically said, mate, we can't keep you. So that was sort of a bit of a shock, and the fact that Brisbane, I suppose, never paid a cent for me. As I said, I was on a news limited contract, so the actual Broncos club didn't actually pay for me. But, like, I suppose a bit to Wayne's credit, he sort of reached out some feelers. I was sort of looking at South back then, and he said, no, you don't want to go there. And then I end up sort of, having a bit of a conversation with Royce Simmons, who was going to be the coach, and decided, So Royce said that, obviously, I didn't want to go down there because Gowie was playing hooker at that sort of stage, but he sort of made it clear that Gowie was going to be the halfback. So I thought that was a good opportunity. Gowie's obviously a superstar from a young age. I remember playing him in an under 21 trial, and he would have been 17 or 18 and carved us apart. So I thought, this is a good opportunity to play with a great halfback, which he turned out to be. So came down there and still here. So even though I sort of went and played with St. George, Penrith is still home. I'm still sort of out here in the Rith. It's a great community, and love my time out here.
That's good to see you're still there, mate. You're still a legend. Obviously, Clive Churchill medalist from out there. But, mate, just before we go into the Penrith, you spoke about going from Origin and then getting told, or not that you wanted, but we just can't keep you. You go from one high to a massive low. Not wanted, sorry. You go from a huge high to a low. Like, how did you get yourself through that?
Yeah, it was pretty daunting, to be honest, as I said, because been around footy long enough by that sort of stage to know the negotiations, and thought that we'll back and forth, blah, blah, blah. But, to obviously come off winning 2000 and grand final representing New South Wales in 2001, which obviously we lost, and Alfie come back that year and beat us in the last game, little prick. But, it was pretty hard because obviously I just basically brought our first place there in Brisbane. We sort of built a place and sort of started calling Brizzy home. Kids had just sort of started school, or our oldest anyway, so to then upheave and move all the way back to Sydney, because obviously there was no other sort of Queensland club back then. I wasn't going to Townsville. So that was sort of pretty daunting. Yeah, probably felt a bit flat, but, one door opens, one door closes, one door opens, and that's sort of basically what we had to do. That's what professional rugby league is about. So I cried a little bit, but land on the feet down here in Penrith. Probably not the first year, but got a fair few phone calls in that first year when we got the wooden spoon. But that second year in 2003, big deal, didn't answer his phone when I rang him back.
I love that so much. So talk to us. You get there your first year. Obviously, you just said that you got the wooden spoon. How do you turn that around to the next year, 2003, and then what we saw was absolutely unbelievable to win that premiership?
Yeah, I think it was the players, a couple of senior players. We had Sats back there, myself. And again, I suppose culture was a bit different, obviously, coming in here. And I remember playing, I think we played Parramatta the first game, and everyone was G'd up to play Parramatta, obviously, the Battle of the West, as they call it these days. But the reason they all G'd up was because Parramatta was so good and Penrith weren't so good. And we thought we had a chance to win because we were playing them first up before they got sort of any combinations going. So I suppose that looking back in it, when you're going into a game thinking, oh, we've got a chance only because we're playing these guys first up, if we're playing them sort of mid-season, we're going to get rolled. That was probably the culture of the club that sort of needed to be changed, and that's obviously what happened throughout the sort of year. But, yeah, I think there was a couple of key players, myself, Gowie, Sats. We sort of basically pushed some of these young kids to start doing extras. Again, I suppose there was a bit of a mentality. Lingy, great coach, but a bit of an old school mentality of, as you said, if you're playing first grade, you know all those basic bits and pieces, where you had sort of a bloke like Lukey Lewis come up, didn't know the difference between overs and unders. So when you're sort of having those conversations and thinking, wow, this kid's sort of playing first grade as a 17, 18-year-old and he's never heard overs and unders. So a few of us sort of got together and we got down the training before training started, and we'd sort of run some exercises and some drills so that and everyone sort of started to buy in, and that's sort of where it got to. So Lenny still coached the side how it needed to be coached, but the senior players of the group basically got us to where we sort of Lenny's game plans and that would be able to action, because they actually understood what we needed to do.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. It's always the leaders that do encourage those things. And, I had Luke Lewis. He's one of the best leaders I've had. And I can't wait to say talk to him about unders and overs, because he knows what they are now. But so glad to hear that everyone has a starting point, mate. One of the two players I loved watching at 2003 was the Hebert bunch, Nullavau and Politua. And you were a hooker that used to bring the blokes onto the ball. Mate, geez, you would have had some fun with those two units on the outside of you.
It was, we just had a bit of an understanding too. And you ask any sort of good hooker, sometimes you don't have to say anything to a bloke. You sort of just look at him and they know what's to be prepared. And they were, and even sort of like a bloke like Frankie Pritchard, who sort of come up a bit later, I had that sort of same understanding with him as well. That's sort of the key. So, but yeah, Joey and Big T, they obviously played a pivotal part in the premiership title in 2003, and obviously Jolly Clinton being a front row, but he was sort of young and ruthless as well, but he played his part. But those two obviously sort of a couple of times won us some games that got us out of trouble. And again, I think T had sort of been there as a young bloke coming through that sort of system and probably, again, that culture, you sort of think, okay, well, this is where T got to, when there was sort of that good culture around him. So I think he really enjoyed it. And as Richo used to say, Joey was eating paint chips off his unit wall back in those days. Now he used to sort of, we were sponsored by Kellogg's. I don't know. Back in those days, we had a big warehouse where we used to train out of that, and they got the big bloody boxes full of 10 packs of 1 kilo cereal and that. And Joey didn't drive. He'd lost his license. Somehow he just wasn't licensed, but he'd always scab a lift home and he'd say, oh, hang on, mate, hang on. And he'd come out with all this cereal that you'd have to throw in the back of your car so that he could take it home and feed the kids. But they're two sensational players, and obviously went on to, I think Joey won a premiership over there in Manly as well, from memory. So they obviously took their leadership skills, what they learnt, and delivered to other clubs as well.
You know, we spoke about the Broncos 2000. So yous were expected to win up there. And, the year they had prior, disappointing. They weren't used to losing. You've come to Penrith. You get the wooden spoon in your first year in 2002. 2003, you said you come up against Penrith. You just want to win because you played them early in the season. Parramatta, sorry. You want to win because you play against them early in the season. You can try and knock them off. At what stage in that season did yous have the confidence and belief to know that, look, we're not just here to beat these guys early in the year. We can go on and actually, play for a premiership.
Yeah, I think a young bloke called Preston Campbell came in that year and with Gowie in the halves and provided that bit of spark. So don't think we were noted as defensive side. It got sort of pretty early in the season. It was sort of, I suppose we defended as well as we could, but our mentality was, well, if you score 30 points, we've got the belief that we could score 32 to beat you. And I think you sort of look back in a lot of our results, and that's sort of the way it was. So there was a few games there where our fans would have been on the edge of their seats. But, yeah, we didn't win too many games, sort of, you know, 10-6 or whatever. But not that we didn't concentrate on defence. We had some pretty skillful blokes in attack there. And I said, being a young side, you know, with your Luke Lewis's, your Rooney's, Shane Rodney's, and that sudden come into the picture, they didn't have all that scar tissue from earlier years. I think a lot of those juniors coming up through that Penrith had sort of a winning attitude. So it was probably that, along with the senior players, with our change in attitude, is what sort of all gelled. And, you know, we just had that belief that we didn't give up, you know, some of the games. I think it was St. George. It might have been one of the first semi-finals or one of the last games. You know, we won it right at the end. That was just the belief. We played for the full 80 minutes, and we knew that we always had the chance if we had the ball.
And talk to us about Presto, because obviously he had a few, you know, dramas at Sharks in the back end, and he ended up getting that opportunity to come to you guys with Coach John Ling. Were you just in awe? Because I've been around Preston, obviously he's retired, but he was only small in stature. He was a tiny man, and the things he used to do on the footy field was just remarkable.
Yeah, it was. Mate, he could turn on a dime without moving and still razzle dazzle you. And I think that's the thing that we sort of learnt with Presto, that he'd jump around and maybe play a bit like a headless chook, but you just knew, well, if you ran to a gap, Presto would get you the ball somehow if he wasn't going through the gap yourself. So while it took probably a little bit of time to work out how he played, once we worked that out, you just hit a gap. As I said, and footy's pretty easy. Once you work out what you need to do with the players that you're playing with, it just sort of becomes instinct. And as I said, you know, some of the magic that he sort of put on show on the field, that's what sort of, you know, makes great players great. And, you know, Presto is obviously gone and probably more recognised for some of the stuff that he does off the field, but he was certainly a great player and deserved all the sort of accolades that he got as a player on the field. And obviously off the field, he's doing great things up there with what he's done.
And then obviously, you make the grand final. I think you're the only one that's had a grand final experience in the Panthers side, I think. Am I right?
Yeah, Langy played, I think, in the 97 Super League grand final against Brisbane. So he was probably, if you want to call that a grand final.
We tell Wendell that's half a comp here. Come on. we can't let Wendell get a big head.
So, yeah, apart from him, it was myself, yeah.
Going to this ground was completely different to when you had the Broncos side. They had an amount of experience, you know, internationals, origin players. What was the difference for you into this week? Because you're now the senior player, that you're the only one that's, you know, won a premiership in that side. What was your advice to your teammates, whether it was to soak it in or don't get too nervous? Like, talk to us about your week for grand final.
Oh, that was over 20 years ago, mate. I can't remember what I did last week. But look, to be honest, I did sort of, to myself, I wanted to sort of make a difference. As I said, you know, being in the Brisbane grand final, you know, there was better players and more influential players on the field than sort of myself. As I said, this one, I felt that, you know, I was a senior player, and having that only experience, that I wanted to sort of take some leadership. I suppose it's probably bit of a cliche, no matter, I don't know, you haven't played in the grand final, have you? So probably, yeah, sorry. It's a bit of a cliche.
Not lucky enough, mate.
For those that have played in grand finals, I suppose it's the same thing. You say you need to enjoy the week and soak it in, because you may not sort of get back there. But you also need to make sure that you switch on. You get very limited training sessions. So when you train, you've got to be switched on. That then you've got to be able to switch yourself off. So I think that was probably the main thing. And it's been said many a time, and I think Sats says it a lot as well, because he's obviously in the media, but a lot of the senior players, I think we knew when we went to the grand final breakfast. They obviously have the breakfast these days, back in our days. But we remember, as I said, we got a bunch of young kids. We stayed in overnight because, you know, back in those days, getting from Penrith to into the city where they held the breakfast was a nightmare. So, you know, we get to stay in overnight, and we're up at 6 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock, whatever it was. But, you know, you got all these young kids just buzzing. You know, they're taking photos and all that sort of stuff and enjoying it for what it was. then we sort of look over and the Roosters sort of walk in and they've all got sort of, you know, their suits on and they're as tight as, you know, tight could be. And I think a few of us knew it at that sort of point. Like, there was no smile on their face. Like, they weren't enjoying it. It was like they had all the pressure and, you know, they were there. It was business. And I think a lot of us sort of knew at that point, and we tell the story that that's when we sort of thought that we knew that we were a pretty good chance of winning it, because the young blokes on our side just weren't fazed. They weren't getting overawed. The moment wasn't getting to them, and we had great training sessions. And to see the Roosters when they did come in look like that, yeah, I think a few of us realised back then that that was probably the grand final. It was going to be a hard one to lose.
And talk to us about a particular moment in the grand final. I'm sure one of your mates, Scott Sattler, would always talk to you about it. The tackle. Like, Todd Byrne picks up a loose ball. For all money, you think he's away. Just the moment. How are you feeling?
I was actually pretty pissed off because Sat should have been up there chasing it. If you actually have a look at it, and he doesn't say this, but if you have a look at it, he should have been actually up in the line chasing. But, it's obviously goes down in fake haulers. Would we have won if he doesn't make that tackle? We don't know. But obviously, you know, great players make great actions during high-pressure games, and, you know, Sats has sort of made that, and it allows us, obviously, the rest of us to go on and finish that game off and to win. So you could say if, but, whatever, but he made the tackle. That's sort of as simple as it is, and one of those big things on a big stage that he'll keep wrapping himself for the next 20 years until he can't remember it.
Oh, well, mate, we still talk about our training, like our play, never give up. It's called a Scotty Sattler play. So, mate, people don't forget about those big moments. And then for yourself, like, you had an absolute blinder for that, for the grand final. You know, I think you set up Luke Rooney, you know, made a couple of line breaks. And to win the, you know, the Clive Churchill medal, which is best on ground in an NRL grand final, was that a personal highlight for your career?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I obviously got to represent New South Wales for a couple of games, and now I did sort of play, I'll say, two test matches, one Super League one normal one. So, no, to me, the pinnacle is always representing your country. Unfortunately, I had a bloke called Denny Badiris that was linked with, obviously, Johnsy there that stayed there, kept me out for most of my career, but obviously representing country, I think that's the pinnacle. But from a one game thing, yeah, to become obviously the first hooker to win the Clive Churchill, that was something that can never be taken away out of the history books. Obviously, a few hookers have gone on to win it since, but to be the first one, that was great. And obviously to be the first one in Penrith, as much as Royce probably should have won it back at 91, he didn't. So, no, Royce, you did not win that one. We edge each other on about that. But, yeah, obviously all the stars aligned, but, you know, you've still got to have 17 other blokes on the field with you to make things happen. And it was just sort of one of those games where I backed myself a few times and it sort of come off.
Yeah, mate, you're absolutely outstanding. As I said, Clive Churchill for a reason, best player on ground. As an old boy of the Panthers, are you absolutely in awe of what they've achieved in the last, you know, not just three, but 4 years? They made, you know, they lose the grand final 4 years ago, but then win three straight and are still the number one side to beat.
Oh, yeah. I suppose when I think it was Fish said, no, we're the best ever or whatever, some people sort of criticised him and that, but when you look at results, they are. Like, you can't go back and compare eras. Again, with that side, Penrith in 91, would 91 beat us in 2003? You can't do that. But when you sort of think of the modern game and they said four grand finals in a row and they've won back to back to back, that sort of it is undisputed that they'll go down as sort of the best side in Penrith history, if not close to, I suppose, at least in the NRL era. Obviously, you've got your sides like South and that won multiple premierships back in the day. And that's where you say you can't compare eras, but from the modern NRL era, they're going to be a hard sight to sort of someone to come along in history and win sort of three in a row. And as you said, potentially still in the hunt this year for four in a row. So especially with the salary cap, maybe the way that the salary cap's managed with those young blokes, that they've sort of gotten a couple of extra years out of them than what I suppose the more experienced side would have had. Obviously, there's a few of the players starting to break away now, and that's well deserved. No, let's be realistic. You play the game because you love it, but you also play the game because it's an income and you can set your family up. So you can't sort of knock anyone for leaving. But yeah, they're a great side. And again, when you look back, as I said, Wayne Bennett keeping the simple things simple. You watch Penrith, and a lot of the time, the execution is what wins them the games. You know, their passes are out in front, and it's those things. The player doesn't have to stop and pass the ball because it's halfway behind him. They're all out in front. They all fan out with their players the way that they train, and you probably find that they probably train a lot harder than what they actually play, being down there to a few sessions.
Yeah, they're an outstanding, you know, just a quality outfit. And you've won two competitions yourself, Luke. How hard is it to go that next season when you're at the top of you're at the top of the food chain? Everyone just wants to knock you down.
Yeah, it certainly is. And again, I suppose back with Brisbane, everyone that played Brisbane got up for Brisbane, whether you won a grand final or not. Penrith, yeah, that second year, everyone's after you. Again, we fell one game short. Obviously, the Bulldogs sort of knocked us out. I remember Reece got simmed in with, I think it was 15 minutes to go, so we were down and they beat us, which was, very disappointing. So I thought we would have won that comp if we'd won that game as well. But that's rugby league, isn't it? Nate, you've got your sides and everyone wants to be on top after it. So, again, going back to Penrith, to be doing it 4 years in a row. Yes, they didn't win so the first year, but they were sort of on top. But that's what sort of your good sides. But you've got your Melbournes in that as well. Now, obviously, they've just been there at the top for so long. Yes, they might not have been winning sort of minor premierships and all that all those years, but they've never gone away. And that was one game I always look forward to as well. Now, when you play your Brisbanes, your Melbournes, doesn't matter whether they won the year before or not, everyone aims up for those sides. So you've got your sort of top four, I suppose, that those sides that are always sitting up the top that you've always got yourself up for. But, yeah, it's just amazing that Penrith have been able to stay up there for so long and, as I said, still being there with a chance of a good chance this year, no touch wood with injuries, of potentially getting to another grand final.
Yeah, definitely. And they just set the standard for the whole NRL competition, don't they? Your teammate, Ryan Girdler, one of Triple M's very own. Have you got anything for us on the big fella? Because he's just a good-looking man, clean skin, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's gone all hippie and shit up the coast now, isn't he? Like, hey, I don't know. Bit of a weirdo, to be honest.
We'll take that. That's something on him.
A little bit of a weirdo. look, obviously I haven't sort of kept in contact with Gerds, to be honest, once he sort of left and I left. But, you know, I suppose the good thing, and you'd attest to this, Woodsy, it doesn't matter who you play with, where you played with them. If you get back and you come together for a couple of beers or whatever, it's just like sort of yesterday. Maybe Gerds might actually come down from the bush this year and come to our reunion because he's sort of been stiffing us for the last couple of years. So it'd be good to see what the hippie Gerds looks like and what he drinks, to be honest.
He's doing all this breathing stuff and cold plunges.
He's always looked good, mate.
He was a big favourite in our household. Don't worry about that. So end of 2008, how do you find out that you obviously were you not wanted again at Penrith or was it just time to move on with salary cap reasons and then you reunite with Wayne again at the Dragons?
Yeah, no, probably didn't have the 2007-2008 new coach that sort of came in. Probably wasn't a good fit, to be honest, so I'm not going to sort of go too much into that. I said loose lips sink ships, but Matty Elliott wasn't probably the coach that doesn't disagree. I suppose put the story out there is that, again, did everything that was asked of us. I suppose I'd got to that sort of stage at the club where a lot of the young blokes, again, sort of starting to come through. We had a lot of sort of obviously Islander boys, et cetera, that would prefer to come to me as a leader rather than go and talk to the coach, et cetera. So I probably felt that I was the one that was always delivering the negative stuff and then it sort of maybe came back on me that I was the one that was sort of causing the disruptions and that, which 100% wasn't sort of true. And I suppose that the one thing that sort of really hurt me is that sort of one of the trainers and said I won't sort of mention his name, called me selfish. That sort of really hit me pretty hard in 2007 because everyone's got to be selfish to make it as a top sports person. But in that regard, it's selfish in terms of ourselves and our family. I was selfish that I moved my family from Canberra to Brisbane to Penrith, and now at the end of the day sort of decided that I'd stay in Penrith and travel down to Wollongong. I never sort of saw myself as being selfish. And for someone that barely knew me to come out and say that, that really hurt. I suppose the good thing back in then in 2008, when they actually wanted me back because they realised that they didn't do any better without me. In 2008, they called me back. That person apologised to me, but it was probably quite clear that I wasn't wanted any further at the club. So I got a bit of a wind that Wayne was talking to the Dragons, and I thought, well, realistically, I'm not going to go to another Sydney club. I didn't want to travel like over to play with the Roosters. That would just be bloody torture, even though great club. And again, mine was now not being selfish and trying to think about sort of the family and that. I think Piggy Riddell was leaving Parramatta. That was probably the only other club that I sort of probably reached out to, but yeah, they weren't interested. So went down to St. George, and yeah, Wayne obviously was looking for a couple of players that knew what his style was. Obviously, that's why Big Dell was there as well, kept him on, brought me down. So it was sort of good to reunite, but I don't know, probably the club atmosphere down there was a little bit different to what I was sort of used to. To me, it felt like I was sort of going back into sort of schoolboys mentality, like back into sort of year 11 and 12, and I was a 31-year-old man at that stage and felt like I was going back to school in terms of some of the mentality of that sort of stuff. But to me, playing football was what I wanted to achieve, and I sort of got to play my 3-round game for down there for St. George. So that was the highlight, I suppose, I'd take from St. George was, there were some great players down there that I played with. And to be able to sort of finally play that 300th game was great.
Well, that's outstanding, mate. 300 games is a huge achievement. There's only, I think it was 51 of them now. So you are one of those 51 players. And you can think of all the players that have played NRL, only 51 have made that 300 games, mate. It's a remarkable achievement for yourself. Like you said, you reunite with Wayne in 2009. Then I think it was the second year. Did he tell you to retire? Because he's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so he told me in 2009 to retire. So that was probably the first time I'd played for a club that I hadn't lived local. Okay, so again, Canberra, played with Canberra, Brisbane, Penrith, played with Penrith, even though we had some players at Penrith that used to travel. To me, it was always being there. But I suppose at that point, is going back to the selfishness thing, I decided that I wasn't going to move my kids out of school for what was going to be sort of a time for 2 years. I didn't think that was the right thing to do. So I sort of travelled down, travelled back. Wayne sort of gave me days off where I didn't have to go down for the rehab session, et cetera, down there, and I could do it back up here because he knew I was professional enough to do it. And then we weren't obviously getting some results back then. And I suppose in hindsight, I decided to sort of move down there part-time on sort of in 2010, but I sort of basically difference to 2009 was that I think there was video sessions. If you're not in the video sessions, it's a bit hard to sort of defend yourself, especially when you've got sort of, you're losing and you then find out some other players that sort of said this and that, mm-hmm. that probably wasn't totally correct. So yeah, I got banished to, was it Shell Harbour back in those days? which was even a longer trip. I'm travelling sort of over an hour to get down the Wollongong from Penrith, and then I'm at I think it was an extra 25 minutes or so, half an hour, to Shell Harbour training at whatever time. But, look, that was, I suppose, an experience of getting back to grassroots rugby league again. Again, there was myself and Matty Head. So he joined me at Shell Harbour for a few games and to play with blokes that weren't getting paid. You know, there was probably blokes there that were after the opportunity to maybe put their hand up for sort of St. George. There was blokes playing A grade that were getting paid more than sort of the players that were playing in like the Shell Harbour side I was playing with. So to go back there, it probably gave you that passion again. But it was a hard time. And then, yeah, that off-season sort of Wayne sort of rang up and told me that I'd be playing with Shell Harbour again. And I said, that's fine, Wayne. I've got a contract. You can pay me out and that'll be fine. And he went, oh, no. I went, well, I'll see you at pre-season then. I'll be happy to go to Shell Harbour and earn my money. And look, that's the way it was out. He basically, I remember I had that conversation. I was sitting in the car, in the car park waiting to pick my kids up from school. And basically just said, well, mate, I'm prepared to play for Shell Harbour for next year to fulfill my contract. So you talk to most blokes, Woodsy, and they'll tell you that I'm pretty tight when it comes to money. So I wasn't giving up my money just because I had to travel a couple of extra Ks, even though I probably earned more sort of working in my business and what I did sort of for those 2 years down at St. George. But yeah, then again, that's the way it started, and been a good clubman, went out there, and I think it was Parramatta that St. George played first up, and Feeney broke his ankle. So I was I think that might have been a Friday night or a Saturday. I can't quite remember. And I said I was just sitting in the dugout, you know, ready to go and play for Shell Harbour that weekend. And obviously Wayne sort of sent the message down that, Predo, you're not playing for Shell Harbour. You need to come down and do some fitness because you're not playing. And was in the side the following week. So, yeah, got to play the majority of that year. I suppose disappointing end was being told I was in the side, and then sort of I think it was about 3 or 4 games out from semis. And look, when you go back to, he asked me the question about in 2000 or 2003, when did you know sort of that you're going to win that comp? I was pretty confident sort of halfway through that year that it was going to be take a good side to beat St. George that year. Obviously, they got sort of the semis the year before and went sort of out the back door sort of 2 games in a row. But you just get that feeling, and it just felt that was the year that was sort of happening. And then, got a bit of a bum steer from Wayne towards the end of that, and that was sort of the last game that I played.
And then so Luke, after that last year, you retired. You're doing a lot of work for Luke Pritis Foundation. Whereabouts are you at with that now?
Yeah, so the foundation was started in 2006, so I'm still the chair of that. We're still sort of pumping along here in Penrith. Obviously, COVID times knocked everyone, certainly us, and we're still sort of trying to get back on our sort of feet, but we're still going all right.
Yeah,
times, I suppose, are getting tough for everyone all around with the cost of living, et cetera. So we've got looking at a couple of events coming up this year. So we had a boxing event, but we got a bum steer from the council, and we had to cancel that. But we've got a couple other events that are coming up, and our golf day is always sort of successful towards the end of the year. So we're still sort of out there helping. We help over sort of 100 odd families here, not only the kids with autism, but obviously know the families as well, because that's the main thing. And you've got to be able to sort of help the families help their own child as well, as much as the therapy, and that helps the child directly. You've got to have the whole family unit trying to support each other, because obviously, you know, if you've got other siblings in the household, etc., as well, then you know they can sometimes take a bit of backseat, which you've got to get that balance right, which is hard. And as I said, before we talk, Woodsy, you know, Cooper now is 22, and now he's out of school. Now he goes to day program, and sort of we're battling along with the NDIS now to sort of get him some sort of independent living. Because just like most 22-year-olds, they went, well, you expect them to start looking to move out of house, et cetera. And again, it's for his best long-term, that if something happened to sort of myself or Holly, we'd want him to have his own place that he's supported without sort of having to rely on mum and dad for the rest of his life. So you never grow out of autism. The changes just get more difficult as they get older, but always say that there's always someone in a worse position than yourself, so that sort of gets us through some of the tough days. And again, with the foundation, to get some feedback that the team has made a significant difference in someone's life, that makes it all the worthwhile to keep things rocking and rolling.
Oh, that's awesome, mate, and it's so good to see out there making a difference. Obviously, can be challenging, but you've got the spirit to move on, and you know, always thinking positive, mate. Just got one more last question. I like to ask a lot of the blokes that have retired. The rugby league this day and age, how do you see it? And is the things that, what do you dislike about it? And what would you change if to make it a better game for yourself?
I suppose things I'd stop would be all the changes, to be honest. I think, look, and I can understand, it's an entertainment business. Obviously, now they've gone to Las Vegas, and obviously you enjoyed your trip over there, or your 2 trips, I think you got, didn't you? two. So understand that.
But it's a great product, and it's been a great product since 1908 when it sort of started. So I don't think we need to keep tinkering year after year just to say that we're making it a better product. It all comes in swings and roundabouts. As much as the attacking flair gets to it, when sides are you're winning games by 40-30, then the other side swings around and goes, "What about the defence?" So I think they've got a good balance at the moment, and I just sort of think leave it alone for a few years now. I don't think there's too much more that you can change without actually taking the combative part of the game away. And I know Ted Knox and listen to you guys in the Triple M talk about it and all that sort of stuff. And obviously that's a massive thing in the game. And I've got a young grandchild that's sort of about to turn 5 and he's starting to play footy this year. But my worry is with bringing in this tag system is that all the kids now and use their arms and that to try and pull these tags. If we wanted our kids to play Oztag, then there's a game called Oztag. I just fear that you're setting kids up when they get to the stage that they have to tackle, that they've had 3 or 4 years of trying to pull these tags off, that they're going to get their head in the wrong position and they're not going to know the right technique. And look, there's things for both sides, but as much as we don't want our kids to have head knocks and that, I really like to see the statistics that says that of how many kids that have been sort of 5 or 6 year olds have actually been knocked out with concussions. I think we're better off teaching them the right technique at an early age rather than getting to sort of 8, 9, and 10, where the kids have been pulling tags off for 5 years and now trying to change that technique of arms and legs. So that's, I suppose, my thing. Stop meddling with the game so much. Most players know. There's awareness and that's going to grow. And now we've got obviously a legend out here in Royce Simmons that's now got the early dementia, etc. And he's doing great things. But I think you put it across the board, yes, sometimes we can be not put ourselves first, but I think the game, that's the one thing in the game that I think has got a lot better is taking those decisions of whether you're staying on the field and that out of the hands of the players. So I commend the guys for that. But let's sort of just, rugby league's still a combative sport, so we're still going to let it be that way. And every player that takes that field knows, I suppose, that there is now a real height risk that you're going to be doing sort of damage long term. Players don't want to take that risk, they won't play. I think we've sort of got to let players make that choice and stop, I think, harming the kids. So I really think that we're going to get to a next generation of footballers that don't know how to tackle properly, which is a bigger concern than what's happening at the moment.
Mate, that's well said. That's one of the best takes I've heard so far in a long time. So my little fella's going through at the moment playing tag, and I agree with you. You've got to learn to tackle at a young age, otherwise you practice bad habits. Luke, mate, thank you so much for taking time out. We appreciate your time, and it was awesome to have a yarn on your journey, mate, and I can't thank you enough for joining Woodsy's Footy Talk. Thank you so much, mate. Appreciate it, big fella.
Appreciate it, Woodsy, and good luck for the season, mate.
Thanks, mate.